Atlantis, The Dark Continent. A book by Paul Williamson and Linda Braithwaite. Read by JP on Wolf Spirit Radio. Atlantis, The Dark Continent. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
All right, so this is Paul, the author, and he was, in this lifetime, he was called John, just J-O-N. So there's Elena and John. Right, okay, so... after the earthquake. Later on, after the earthquake, when Elena had become injured and lost her baby through miscarriage, I stayed in the healing hospital with her day and night while she continued to be unconscious. At some point, Elena needed psychic surgery to stop internal bleeding in her abdomen, and I was grateful to be allowed to stay and observe this. There were three healers working, one at the head, another at the feet, and a senior healer, who was a woman, performing the actual operation. During the operation, Elena's body was very calm and still. I could sense an enormous energy from the healer's hands, creating a shimmering effect through the whole body. I felt that this was giving protection to Elena, so she could cope with the structural alterations to her energy field. Meanwhile, I was trying to send love to her, and I felt I was reaching her. The senior healer did not touch Elena's physical body, but moved her hands, manipulating Elena's auric field. I was so attuned to Elena that I could feel the alterations to her energy field in my own body. It felt like all the knots and damage were being put aside and new pathways were being created to the healing energy flow and the bleeding stop. I felt some marvelous sensations inside me while the healer did this, and I later knew that her work was succeeding. At this moment, I decided that I wanted to do healing and energy work myself. Architecture was not quite sufficient to fulfill my desires. I wanted to help heal the earth, repair the damage to our land, and build a new and happier society. Elena and I were very close. We could sense each other's thoughts and feelings very keenly when we wanted. Also, we were also aware that we had our own spiritual guide helping us, so we knew that there was a spiritual connection for us from beyond the earth. However, the beauty of the land and life where we lived was very intoxicating and enveloping for us. Although it was not much talked about, I could sense that I had lived before. When we travelled, the places we visited where we did our work felt like important personal connections for me from my past. When we went to the West to help with the construction of the astronomical temple, I felt that the man in charge of this project wanted to form a link between the spirit of the earth and the star Sirius. Linda, as Elena, referred to this star as Aridian. He told us that there were planets around Sirius that supported life, and that once this had been his home. He felt that the link between the energy of Sirius and the energy of Earth had to be strengthened. Much knowledge had been lost, and he wanted to create this temple to attempt to regain it. The energy from Sirius would be focused using crystals from within the temple, and would be grounded by the conductor stones which we laid along the earth meridian passing through the temple. I must say that I did not fully understand what he was doing, but the temple seems quite a magical place, and it felt a privilege to have a small part in its construction. The old man appeared to be a very wise soul, and he had many pupils wanting to learn from him. Going to the area of destruction at the very southern tip of our land was very important to me. sensing that this area had been devastated by the activities of the people in the long distant past. I wondered if I had some part in this. I felt strongly that I had personal mission to repair this damage. Sitting in the hole at the center of this barren land, we had to ask our guides to protect us from the radiation, which seemed to want to attack our energy fields. We had to place a large column of basalt deep into the earth here. Then we needed to use our thought power and imagination to bring spiritual energies down through the basalt to create roots of energy lines that would go deep into the earth. The energy disturbance was not just on the surface of this land, but underneath too. So we had to keep working using all our concentration and inner resources further and further until we could feel that the energy lines we had constructed were reaching the active lines of the earth spirit again. By the time we did this, we felt the energy change and the release of tensions, but we were utterly exhausted. Then we just slept where we'd been working. Afterwards, it was a wonderful feeling to know that we had succeeded. We went to the village closest to where we had been and told them what we had done. No one from that village ever came into the devastated area, so they were very curious. Of course, they all noticed the change and were very excited like us. In the days that followed, they helped us plant seeds all over this area. We felt that life wanted to return here. Elena and I discovered two places which could become power points, where temples could be constructed to strengthen the energy more. Some of the people from the village said they would like to start a settlement there. We wished them well, and I felt a lot of satisfaction. Another place where we visited was an old ruined temple, situated on a hillside, again in the far south of the land. Here, there was a man who had been a tutor at the university we attended. He was trying to organize people to build a settlement in the region. We were helping him to find the site for a new temple, quite close to where the old one had been situated. Around the old temple, we found fragments of what seemed like shattered crystal. We sensed a lot of pain emanating from these pieces. With some assistance from the others, we felt compelled to gather these pieces together. Then we found a hollow and buried them within the earth, covering them with shielding stones to protect them. We felt we were doing what the pieces of crystal wanted, and we meditated and sent prayers asking that these fragments may be united with the spirit of the earth. As John, this place seemed familiar, and afterwards I wondered, as Paul, if it had made me the same site where long ago the military temple had existed that had featured for me in the lifetime of the Crystal War. Later on, we laid the foundations for this new temple. For this, it appeared that we used basalt rock. The basalt has a strong energy coming from deep within the earth through volcanic action. So, placing this at the base of buildings helped connect that place more fully with the inner earth and its lines of energy. We had to cleave large pieces of this rock into the shape we wanted for this purpose. So we first asked permission of the rock. Then, through meditation, we would conduct energy and use visualization until the rock would move apart along the natural energy lines within it. We could shape the rock to be more angular at one end, and this would then be the end that was directed down into the earth. One other place where we were called to visit was a sanctuary in the mountains. I felt very much at home here, and sensed that I had lived many lives in such places. These people had problems because the earth movements had meant their earth sanctuary was now slightly out of alignment, and we were asked to help build a new one in a more appropriate position. We found the residents of this sanctuary were in dispute with each other, and there was much unhappiness amongst them. I was called to try to mediate and help them. I found that I could do this very well, after listening to all sides and offering my suggestions. Two of the people decided to leave, and the atmosphere of the place became much more peaceful. As Paul, I again wondered if this episode related to my life in the Crystal War. Perhaps in that earlier life I had stopped my efforts too soon, and now I was needing to make up for it in this way. However, Once more, I seemed to be successful, and at the end of that life with Alanya, it felt that a great deal of positivity, good, of a great, with Alanya, it felt like a great deal of positive good had been achieved. The therapeutic value of this experience for me was mainly in helping me to know more about my personal history, and the history of Atlantis as well, as giving me comfort for the satisfying work I did then. For Linda, her regression as Alanya was one of the first Atlantean lives she visited. With such a lot of beauty and positive energy, it gave her much incentive to continue these explorations. At this stage, I don't think she was aware of how difficult this may be for her. Some people can be guided from within to gentle, satisfying past life experiences as a beginning and introduction to what may prove later to be more challenging therapeutic work. Certainly, this is true in the case of Linda. Among the many, many people with whom I associated with in that life, I sensed that my mother then was the same soul as Lynn. I think that Denise may have had a minor role as one of the other healers who was sometimes working with us. Commentary by Albani. Paul, can you tell us about the Golden Age of Atlantis? People, imagine two pictures of Atlantis. They are the most common image. If you ask the average person, suppose Atlantis existed, how do you imagine it would be? They would answer in two ways. One, that the continent was corrupt and used crystal power in a bad way, ultimately destroying itself. This is correct. The second answer would be that it was a beautiful place where people lived in peace with nature and allowed their better side to come forward. This is also correct. That is the period of which you are speaking. Paul asks, how did this era begin? Albani, there was a long period of recovery after the damage caused by the Crystal War. Even though the North was not involved, it still sustained... damage. With the massive cataclysmic change which happened in the southern part of the island, it caused problems with the north also, for there was a great deal of dust and volcanic ash thrown into the atmosphere. This drifted northwards, and a lot of it settled over the northern section. This caused problems for quite some time. So, although the north did not sustain so much physical damage, change occurred. Therefore, the recovery period actually involved all of the continent in different ways. This took a long time. It took many, many hundreds of years for the population to recover, for the land to settle, and for the things to return to some semblance of normal. In this time, the memory of people carried forward the horrors of what happened. There was a great resolving never to allow this to happen again. It was carried down in oral tradition, stories and written work of what this dreadful thing was that had happened. And so it was resolved, almost simultaneously amongst the people, that they would learn to live in peace with each other, develop a peaceful civilization, and work very hard at healing the damage that he had done. This is the onset of what you refer to as the Golden Age. This was indeed a wonderful period. The time of total stability was roughly 1500 years. Towards the end of that time, things were beginning to change again. Paul asks, where does Elena's lifetime fit into this? It is roughly in the middle, as there are some of the other lives, as are some of the other lives you have come across. Over that period, there was a great deal of healing energy and healing work done. For many souls, lives during this time tended to be very positive, and a great deal of beauty was produced. Paul asks, how did the Golden Age develop? It took some time to develop to its peak, as you can probably appreciate. Eventually, when things died down, people were quite put off by any thought of fighting and war. It was a gradual realization and a gradual building up of the more peaceful aspects of society. Paul asks, so would the Golden Age be from about 16,000 to 14,500 BC? Albani replies, that is about the period to which you refer. roughly. It peaked towards the end of that period, when again things started to backslide slightly. The peak came towards the end when much development had been done and much progress had been made. You realize when you compare the Atlantean timescales with modern-day humanity, and you may wonder, I'm sure, and readers may wonder, why the Atlanteans never developed things like cars and television, and the modern things you have now. For they had equal time to do it. In fact, they had longer. But there was no industrial revolution, as you called it. It did not happen on Atlantis, for they used different power sources, as in crystal energy and earth energy. They saw no need to develop other forms of energy which you have developed in the modern world. I believe that your industrial revolution started with the use of steam power and things like that, from the basic elements of the earth. This did not happen on Atlantis, for they saw no need. There was no drive to develop that kind of society and technology. Their technology, as such, if you want to use it in a broad sense, was developed far more along psychic lines, with earth healing in general, psychic surgery and this kind of thing in the medical field. The people communicated very often by telepathy and using crystals. So things like your modern-day communication systems were not required. They simply did not have any need to develop this kind of thing and therefore did not see it. I'm sure had the need been there, then the minds of the time would have produced this kind of social change. Paul asks, what kind of government existed in those times? Albani replies, government, during the Golden Age as you refer to it, was essentially total democracy. The people who led the various areas, towns, cities, were chosen by the people who lived there. They were chosen for their outstanding qualities, their uprightness, their honesty, and their understanding of peaceful things. Anyone who was seen as aggressive or arrogant or wanting their own power would simply not have made it through the system. They were chosen very much by feelings, by the energetic values of that person. They were chosen for their kindness and understanding and compassion. It was essentially a very caring society. You would have a council of a number of people. This varied according to where you were. Some of the larger towns and cities had a larger group. As in your system today, each person would be responsible for a certain area or a certain field of activity. They would bring together all their various skills to run the city efficiently. This worked. It worked extremely well. People were cared for and looked after. From the bottom of society upwards, everyone respected what was around them, for there was this great linking with the earth energy. Therefore, all was respected. There were minor problems, of course, there always are, but these were dealt with in a very fair and easy manner. Paul asks, how were children educated in these times? Albany replies, there were various schools and colleges. Often education was started at home. It was common for the parents to educate the children when they were quite young and teach them the basics. The basics also included, again, the honouring of the earth and the energies and the other forms of life around them. The basic literary skills were started quite early in most places. It varied a little. It was quite a large continent and some of the systems were a little different. But inevitably they would move on to a form of higher education as they became older. At the bottom of the society you have the people who do manual work, building and other support jobs. Work that would be considered lower down the social ladder nowadays. Once those children had received the basic literacy and numeracy, skills such as carpentry and making things of various forms would be usually given by the family. Occasionally that child may be sent to another place where that skill was practiced, where they could learn additional skills and stretch their experiences. When you reach further up the social scale, it was far more common for the older children to go to a form of college or university, very often in another geographical area, and to encourage independence and growth. This is not to say that someone from the other classes could not aspire to this. It was open to all, providing they could show that they had the necessary skills required to do the course involved. It is not unlike your current system, but I feel the system there was more open and fair. The universities and schools were supported by the various monies that were collected by the Central Council of Elders, or however you wish to speak of them. They would support there. they would support these. But a lot of it was done through philanthropy. These institutions were supported by individuals, people who had earned their place in life, people who had a good social standing and wealth. These people would more than likely put their wealth into something to benefit others. This was quite common, and it was considered a step up the social ladder if you had built a school or put your name to something or put money into an education establishment or healing temple or something like that. It was considered a very good and kind thing to do. Also, it was good for people's soul, for their own growth and good, essentially for the whole community. Therefore, the needs of the earth, the energies and the people were aligned for this. It was idyllic. It was very beautiful. It was very beautiful and very powerful. This is why the energies worked so well through this period. Paul asks, is it true that some children would be taken away from their families if they had some special gifts, and then they may have someone to teach them specific skills? Albany replies, yes, indeed. This again was a fairly common thing and quite well accepted. For children were taught fairly early by their parents, so that if they showed aptitude in a certain area, then this would be a natural progression. Then they would need to leave their family environment and go to a special place. This often happened with healers. This was the most common field in which this did happen, for the healing could only be taught in many instances in the healing temples, which were often away from society in general. It was accepted at a deep level that they would be parted from their parents and their family. Although it caused distress and sadness, this was only momentary, for they knew that this is the way it had to be. This was the way society ran. They were one of many hundreds. They were not alone, for they were always taken in groups where they could form friendships. They had what you would call nowadays a mentor, who would look after them and care for them. Also, they could visit their families on quite a regular basis. So the family connection was never lost, unless that person, when they grew older, wanted to break that connection. Then that was their choice. The age of maturity was generally about age 16. Paul asks, what was the age expectancy around this time? Albany replies, reasonably high. I feel the average age when people died was probably between 60 and 70. But there were exceptions, of course, as there always are. Disease always existed. But with the healing abilities within many of the areas, this could be conquered to some degree. However, it was accepted. For they understood this much better than people understand in a normal society now, that if a person had chosen to accept a disease as part of their path, then the healers would know this, and they would accept that this was the way that the person had chosen to pass in that life. So in some ways, interference with that would be considered bad. They did ease that person's pain or suffering if they had it, and made the transition far easier for them whenever possible. Paul asks, what was life like in the healing temples at this time? Albany replies, again, this did vary in geographical location, for the most powerful places were the places in the mountains, of which there were many. This was where a lot of people who studied healing would go. But in the bigger cities, there were also healing sanctuaries and temples where healers worked with the population. Of course, their numbers were greater there. They were structured in much the same manner, then. There would be one senior person in charge, and they would organize the activities of the various people under their control, the other healers. Healers would often work in pairs as a male-female pairing, although this was not always the case. It varied tremendously. There was also a system where the healers traveled out to those who could not get to them. With emergencies, accidents, and problems, healers would go out, or people would be brought. It worked on a loose basis. The actual sanctuary or temple needed to be prepared for anything that may happen. Healing was done at all levels. It was done for all the various problems that beset humanity, including physical illness, accidents, and mental illness. These were treated by the healers in different ways. There were variations in the way this was applied, but on the whole, the techniques used were very, very similar. Crystals were used to accelerate the energy in certain situations. Normal touch and hands-on healing was used. Healing through the auric field and also what you term now as psychic surgery was also used. They also worked with the vibrations of sound and visualization and the bringing forth of spiritual energies, which they could control much more strongly than in our contemporary times, for they could deal with a great deal of different situations. If there was, for example, a disaster, like a volcanic eruption or an earthquake or some form of major accident, then teams of healers would go to that area to effect rescue of the souls involved, to administer healing and pain control, to help with any form of injury, and also help to with the aftercare of the injured and people involved. They well knew that these things brought about mental stress and difficulties, which you're only just beginning to address in your society today. They well understood the effects on the mind of traumatic experiences. Therefore, they could help with this at all levels. Paul asks, what were the main spiritual beliefs of the general population? Albany replies, most people believed in the earth energy and the power of spirit. It was well known and well accepted that people could speak to spirit. In the various corners of the land, different terminology would be used, but essentially they would be speaking to a spiritual being who they knew, a power, a force that was beyond them. They knew there was power and energy operating throughout the land. Each home had a sanctuary. Even the smallest homes would have a tiny sanctuary where the family would meet in the morning, or the members of that group, and they would meditate together or just sit quietly and pray together before the day started. Very often they would do the same at the end of the day and give thanks for whatever had happened, for they were very tuned in to their own needs and the needs of the earth. Hello. How were these sanctuaries set out? They were generally circular, and if we take the average, not the smaller ones or the larger ones, this would be a circular room roughly 7 to 10 metres across. That's about 30 feet. They would often have paintings on the walls of scenes that were meaningful to the people there. Usually, these would be natural scenes of animals, birds or plants. Around the perimeter would be a bench running right around the outside from one side of the doorway right round to the other side of the doorway. In the centre there was always a plinth of some variety, and upon this would either be a flame kept burning in the form of a lamp or a flame that was lit when they went in to meditate. This would be decorated with flowers, fruit or the way the family saw fit. This did vary, for families may have their own way how they wanted to decorate the altar to honour the earth's energy. It was always considered that while the flame was burning, negative thoughts or anything impure should either not be spoken or thought. It was considered a sacred space where each person could commune within themselves. Again, the peoples tended to be well aware of the power within their own souls. They were well aware of that connection with spirit that came from within. By being together, they formed a link. This created a bond of harmony between the people involved. It was an unwritten, accepted rule that anyone with whom you had been in the sanctuary should be someone with whom you would get along. This, of course, did not always happen, but in general, it was considered very bad to have difficulties or arguments with people with whom you would share the sacred space. People would honour the earth energy the earth gives, for the life that she gives, for the waters and the food and the light and the energy from the sun. Some of these sanctuaries had a clear roof so that natural light could come in. This would probably be in the wealthier homes, for glass, although it was used, was considered a very precious substance. Therefore, it would only be the wealthy people who would add this to their sanctuary. Usually, they were just lit by the single flame, or possibly small oil lamps around the side of the walls. In the poorer homes, it will be simply a small circular lamp. in the poorer homes, it would simply be a small circular room with a wooden bench around the outside, and a small wooden plinth in the middle with a flame upon it. Offerings would sometimes be put there if people felt strongly about something for which they would wished it. Offerings would sometimes be put there if people felt strongly about something for which they wished to say thank you. They would bring a small sample of whatever it was and place it upon the altar as a form of gift to the earth and the energies that flowed through this. They saw it as a flowing pattern. Once they were in the sanctuary, the energies flowed around them and through them in a circular manner, from the plinth to them and back again through the floor. Paul asks, and people could actually feel those energies then? Albany replies, oh yes, indeed they could. They knew that once they were in there, they were in a sacred place. It was generally honoured and considered extremely bad to disrupt the energy within a sanctuary. In fact, in some areas it was considered an imprisonable offence. To threaten any kind of violence or angry words within a sanctuary was very much frowned upon. Paul asks, was there any belief in reincarnation at that time? Albina replies, yes, most people held the view of past lives. Most people accepted that you lived many times. That was a common belief. Were there any regional differences in the way people conducted themselves throughout the land at its time? Yes, there were, although there was also much uniformity. There were parts of the southern areas of the continent where the sanctuaries were actually outside. They would be formed in a garden or some external space, for the weather was warmer and more equable. In the northern regions, they tended to stay inside. About three-quarters of the continent had more the inside type of sanctuary. The external ones were decorated with plants, living flowers around in colours which were meaningful for the people involved. Bright colours were used to enhance the energy, for they understood the vibration of the colours. In the north, there were many areas deep within woodland where there were earth sanctuaries. These were often rings of ancient trees where the central area was kept clear, and the central plinth, usually a tree trunk or rocks or stones, would be kept as a sacred space. Anyone could go to these places and sit quietly and contemplate. Otherwise, a group could go and conduct a ceremony, an honouring ceremony, just to feel the energies between them, by linking as a circle. What happened with the arts and music during the Golden Age? They flourished in this time, and people became very aware of the beauty, and of the nature and things around them. Music flourished, for people were aware of the beauty of sound. Concerts were very common. People enjoyed listening to others. People enjoyed performing for others and making beautiful music for their own pleasure. There were many establishments where this was very strong. There were colleges of music. They had a written notation and various forms of instrumentation which are not too different from today's instruments, for essentially they come from the same sources. They need the same physical elements to make sound. Therefore, the shapes and types of instruments that were involved were very similar to today's. They have been throughout time. For, if you need to create sound, the same physical elements of resonance and vibration occurred no matter when you are building the instrument. There were different influences for music according to the area where it was produced. Musicians did travel and performed in other areas. This was considered a very good profession to follow, as was dealing with art and producing beautiful things like pottery, ornamentation, paintings and things of that nature. It was considered a good thing to have something of beauty within your home. It was considered a good vibratory thing to have something that you loved and could respect, that would represent something of yourself and something of the earth to bring into your home. Again, even the humblest of homes had something considered quite beautiful. It may have just been a selection of rocks or pebbles. It may have been a pot or something with lines, but beauty was very much appreciated at all levels of society. Paul asks, what were the forces and factors that led to the end of the Golden Age? Albany, it is the usual story. It is the usual story of people's greed and need to control others. Very gradually, people of ambition and power began to infiltrate the peaceful society. They began very slowly to change things, and those around them who were susceptible or weaker began to see that by attaching themselves, and those around them who were susceptible or weaker began to see that by attaching themselves to the more powerful personalities, they too could gain. And greed crept in. And once these more powerful personalities began to take over, and again this happened in different places at different times, they became desirous of taking other people's things. They were jealous. They wanted the riches of another. And that is when the military establishment started to return again. For these people required protection, for they made themselves disliked. And it is automatic to bring about people who would defend you, in other words, soldiers or the like. It was a very gradual change. Eventually, the greedy and the more competitive element of society crept back in. It happened so slowly that most people didn't even notice. By the time someone in one given town looked at things and said, things aren't going so well, it was too late. For by then change was occurring, and it was occurring in other places also. Had it just been one place, then people would have resisted. But people, by then, in a strange way, had become more apathetic. Because they had had it so good for so long, I don't think they ever conceived that such a thing could ever happen again. But it did. I'm just going to play a track while I get the violet again.
I remember all that you said. I cried a river over you. I cried a river.
Cry me a river, my dear, cry away. Meanwhile, back in Atlantis, chapter 14, Sophira and the Amethyst Sphere. Preliminary comments. In Atlantis, people's nervous systems were very sensitive to the influence of power. People could feel power very easily, and it gave very strong sensations in the body. Therefore, the pursuit of power could be a seductive temptation for many souls. It was possible for souls to lose contact with spiritual love and truth through the thirst for power. Indeed, often this thirst for power came into being when people felt a lack of love in their lives otherwise. However, for people to seek power at the expense of others or the earth could bring much suffering and negativity. Frequently, souls in Atlantis only realized the extent of terrible things they did after they died. These experiences brought with them many lessons for the soul. Linda's soul has always been very sensitive to psychic influences, and in Atlantis, with all its power, Linda's soul had many incarnations where she did not cope very well with this. We have discovered through our exploration that Linda's soul had three particular awful lives where things went badly wrong. The one as Sophira was about the worst. In this lifetime, Sophira killed many, many people, and she enjoyed killing these people. It gave her a sense of power. Some of the souls she killed then, Linda has recognized as people she knows today. This past lifetime was a shocking experience for her to incur. This past lifetime was a shocking experience for her to encounter. Linda realizes that she is still recovering from the ripples and effects of that lifetime in her life now. It has left Linda with a deep fear of power, of hurting other people, and guilt for anything she feels she does wrong. However, for Linda to live through the experiences of this lifetime has helped her to acknowledge her dark side and to start to come to accept herself more fully from within. I feel that she has been very brave to allow herself to experience some of the scenes from this lifetime, but she has known she needed to do this and has come out of the other side feeling stronger as a result. I have recognized that my soul was one of Sophira's victims in that lifetime. The wound of that experience affected my relationship negatively with Linda's soul for many subsequent lives, and I feel I am still learning to love Linda with an open heart and without prejudice or negative expectations. I am not meaning to imply that Linda's soul has hurt me without reply. I am aware from our explorations that my soul in incarnation has also hurt Linda's soul very badly on occasions too. Sometimes I feel that traumatic experiences like that are like wounds, may form scars on the soul and need many lifetimes to heal. In this chapter, Linda will give an account of her various regressions relating to Sophira. It is a censored version. I will also include an account of my regression as Sheeran, Sophira's lover. Then, there are some paragraphs about the parts Lynn and Denise played in the story and a description of a healing process we all went through. We have dated this incarnation from a time at the end of the Golden Age. Not all was bliss, even then. Linda's regression. Sophira. I am in our garden. It is a beautiful place. Our house is large and situated high up at the back of the town. The garden is a series of terraces with lawns and flowers. I am going down to the furthermost point, a balcony that overlooks the other buildings and trees, and the sea is in the distance. I am carrying a black and white seabird. Since I found it with an injured wing some days ago, I have been caring for it. Now it is fully recovered, and I am going to release it, to fly free once more. I love doing this, and it gives me a huge thrill. Holding its light, feathery body close to me one last time, I sweep my hands upwards and let it loose. Quickly, it climbs away into the blue sky, and I feel a surge of love and energy through me. I do this quite often, and I have, in a secluded corner of the garden, a small area of pens and cages where I keep sick and injured birds and small animals. My mother disapproves this because she does not like me doing this. She says it will interfere with my academic studies. I know she has great ambitions for me. She wants me to succeed, to be the best. All the time she pushes me, feeling that caring for my animal friends is a wasted effort, and that my time could be more gainfully employed doing my studies. Father is a musician in our town. There are three of us. I have two brothers who had fathered father and are studying music. I have no interest in that at all. Mother is scientifically trained in geology and has persuaded me that the best way to achieve success is to follow the sciences. I have chosen archaeology and am working towards a university place in one of the nearby cities. She had great ambitions before she married and had us, and now she wants me to gain high honors so she will rise in social standing through me. Quite often I feel her bitterness as being just a mother, and losing what she saw as a promising career. Now she is relying on me, as my brothers are not studying a proper career either. She emphasizes that I must not get too soft or I will lack the drive and determination required to achieve what she wants from me. Her main principle is that I must never allow my feelings to dominate my scientific abilities. Not understanding this, I find it hard to talk to her. She won't listen and just walks away, making her disapproval very obvious. This makes me confused and very unhappy. I have come out of my schoolroom. There is a tremendous noise going on. I can hear birds crying and general raucous laughter and shouting. What I see frightens me. There is a large group of children of all ages. They are deliberately throwing stones into the nearby trees to frighten and disturb the birds. They are on their nests with their babies. I run out, screaming at them to stop. They are hurting them. The birds' cries echo in my ears, and I hate this. Stop! Stop! I shout. Can't you see what you're doing isn't fun? It's cruel. I see a bird fall to the ground below a tree, flapping an obviously injured wing and crying piteously. I push my way through the rowdy throng and scoop it up in my arms. Feeling its heart beating against my chest, I cut my arms around it, trying to protect it. There is blood on its wing. The others come and start to jostle me, calling me names. They push me deliberately, pulling at my arms and clothes to make me drop it. They are pulling at my hair. It hurts. Suddenly, one of the boys grabs the bird from me. I can't stop him. He twists its neck and kills it in front of me. Then, laughing at me, he gives the body back to me. It is so horrible. I feel sick inside. As I start to cry, they all laugh at me, and I try to push through them and run away. I rush home and into our house. As I dash inside, I meet with my mother. I was hoping to get to my room without seeing her. She grabs me by the shoulders and asks me what I am sniveling at. Her tone is sarcastic and contemptuous, but I refuse to answer, looking at the floor, with tears still running down my face. She lifts my chin and slaps me. It stings. Rushing to my room, I cry and cry, not wanting to feel like this ever again. I decide I don't want to show my feelings to anyone. I just want to be hard-hearted like everyone else. Being kind and caring just gets me hurt and humiliated. When I eventually go to my cages, I find that they have been destroyed and the animals and birds are gone. Inside me, I feel an emptiness, a coldness, and a numb sensation in my stomach. No one will ever hurt me again. I will never feel anything, ever. I am older now and at a party. It is a special celebration as it is the evening before all of us from our town will be going to start our university courses. We are all going different ways and I am going to study archaeology as I planned some years ago. The prospect of leaving home and my mother's influence excites me, and I want to gain more independence. But I am sad at leaving my boyfriend. He and I have been seeing each other for some time now. He's the first person towards whom I have been able to feel love. We are together in the garden at our friend's house. There is such a romantic atmosphere. He is very handsome. I am very aware that all the girls like him, but he is with me. We're holding each other close when suddenly one of the girls rushes onto the terrace, screaming abuse at me for stealing him. I feel shocked. She comes across and grabs hold of me, dragging me to the floor and starts to fight me. I respond, but she is stronger than me and tears my dress. Using all my strength, I manage to break away and grab a nearby container of water to throw over her. That feels good. Turning, I run away in tears. Once again, my feelings have let me down. I feel humiliated in front of the others. How could I allow this to happen after all I vowed to myself? I knew it was wrong to feel close to him. This is the end. I will never allow myself to show how I feel again, ever. In fact, I will not allow my feelings to control me anymore. I'm starting a new life tomorrow. People will see a new me. A strong and ambitious person who can get to the top without her emotions getting in the way. This is what I will do, and I will succeed. I will prove to my mother that I can do it, that her little girl is strong and independent and very capable of holding high office. Now it is later. I am in my final year. It has been an interesting course and at times quite difficult, but I am fairly confident of doing well. The others in my group are a mixed bunch, mostly no problem as rivals, but there is one, Sheeran. He is clever and quite a challenge. Like me, he is ambitious and I need to watch him carefully. I have worked hard and do not want to lose anything to anyone, especially him. Those who come top of a group are automatically given a tutorship, and from that position it is easy to become head of department and in charge of the whole faculty of archaeology. That is what I want. There is much power and prestige to be had, and I would be able to organize things the way I would want them and not be ordered around by others. It is later. We are at a dig on one of the ancient temple mounds. Our work here is being assessed as part of our final exam preparations. It is important to find things of interest and evaluate them. We are also expected to help keep records, which I find tedious. Up to now, I have found very little, just insignificant bits and pieces. Something unusual has happened to me. Something unusual has happened to me. I have found this old man, a hermit of sorts, living in a cave in some nearby woodland. I discovered him quite accidentally. One day I was bored and tired with my work as it was hot. I went for a walk away from the dig into the wooded area of hills close by our site. I felt the need to get away from the others too. Sometimes I find their enthusiasm and keenness suffocating. Most of them are pretty hopeless anyway, and they annoy me. This old man is a strange old soul, and seemed to take to me right away. Taking me into his home, he showed me an artifact I have never seen the like of before. A glorious amethyst sphere, incredibly ancient and full of power. He is teaching me to use its energies, and it is absolutely fascinating. It can project thought that is directed into it. He tells me its primary purpose is for healing, and intensifying healing energy to a person or situation in need. But I have realized that it can also be used to gain power, to control what others do and think. Imagine the success I could achieve with it to help me. I must have it. Later tonight, I intend to go to his cave and steal it. As I'm deliberating on this, I hear shouts of excitement from the main area of the dig. I go out and investigate. Wouldn't you know, that man Sheeran has found something of great value and importance. It would be him. That should have been mine. If I had the sphere, I could have done that. I must get it tonight as planned. Now he will get honours and I won't, and they are all treating him like some hero. It's absurd. His name will be on this find and will make him more able to come top in the final exam. But wait. If I have the amethyst, I could arrange things otherwise, couldn't I? It is after midnight. I'm outside the old man's cave. It is quiet. Going in, I see he is asleep, snoring. I go to the box where I know it is kept and lift the lid. It squeaks. Hastily, I grab at the cloth bag where it is kept and slip it into my robes. There's a movement. He's woken up and is shouting at me, grabbing for me. Stupid old fool, he's cursing me. I push him away, for I'm young and strong. He is old and frail. But his hands grip my arms with surprising force. I feel determined to have it. I wrench myself free, lose my balance, and steady myself against the table. There's a knife. I will kill him. No one will know. My fingers close round the handle. He comes towards me. I plunge the knife into him, and he falls without a sound. He's dead. There's blood running across the floor and on my hands. I wipe myself clean and leave. Now I have the sphere, and it's mine. Mine. I feel the weight and shape in my robe. This will give me power, the ability to do what I want. I'll get to the top with this. No one can stop me now.
You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.